Welcome to The Wonder, exploring perspectives, rituals, and observances of modern, naturalistic, earth-revering, pagan religious paths. Here are your hosts, Yucca and Mark.
Welcome, everyone, back to The Wonder, science-based paganism. Today, Mark and I, Yucca, will be talking about values and ethics within our own practices as non-theist pagans, and looking at that from the perspective of the whole pagan community as well. So, welcome, Mark.
Thank you. Good to be here again.
Yeah, it's fantastic. It's been exciting to see that we're starting to get some downloads, starting to get some listens.
Yes, it's really, really gratifying. I'm so excited.
And so before we jump in, let's remind folks the email address that they can send questions to if they would like to hear us talk about a particular topic.
Yes, and that is thewonderpodcastqs@gmail.com. So thewonderpodcast, all one word, qs,
okay,
gmail.com.
So Q isn't just the letter Q.
Just the letter Q-S. For questions. So thewonderpodcastqs@gmail.com. We've already had a couple of feedback emails, which have been great. And we really welcome hearing from you about the podcast and suggestions about topics you'd like us to address or ideas that you have for things we can incorporate into the podcast. That'd be really great.
Yeah, thank you. So this week, so these past weeks, we've been talking a lot about what's been going on seasonally, but we want to address a little bit more of an evergreen topic, which is something that comes up for, I think, not just non-theist pagans, but many pagans in general, and that's the idea of values and ethics. And Mark, before we started recording, you mentioned that it is an accusation often directed towards pagans or even people of just non-Abrahamic religions in general, that we don't have morals or ethics.
Right.
Yeah. So do you want to go ahead and start with your response for that?
Sure. I'm happy to address that. There is a truism that floats around, particularly in more conservative religious circles, but which seems to be kind of an underlying assumption on the part of many people who are Christians or Muslims or Jews, that if you don't have an authority figure dictating to you what your behavior should be, that you won't have any morals, that you will simply act in a kind of sociopathic and destructive, selfish manner, and you won't be considerate towards others or towards the good of your society. And we've learned a lot now about why that isn't true. It's observably not true because there are plenty of atheists out there and they're not killing people and raping people and destroying things. In fact, they tend to be kind of thoughtful. Mm-hmm. But beyond that, there is now really compelling evidence from game theory that altruistic behavior actually is competitively advantageous in terms of evolution. Mm-hmm. Groups work better when people cooperate with one another than they do when everybody is out for themselves. And so there are actually evolutionary reasons why we have evolved to be social animals that cooperate with one another most of the time. And we will continue to do that, whether or not we have a myth about an authority figure telling us what to do.
Yeah, and we see that in humans, but we see that in other social creatures as well, not just within our own species.
Yes, exactly. These benefits of altruism aren't specific to humans. They're just true. They're just mathematically true that it works out better when you help one another. Mm-hmm. And so our inclination is to do that and to be moral agents, even if there isn't a dictation of what that morality ought to be to us.
Yeah.
In fact, I would go a little bit farther and argue that specifically when it relates to conservative flavors of the Abrahamic religion, quite a bit of what authority figures tell people to do is actually destructive. It's not cooperative. It's not kind. Mm-hmm. It sows division amongst people. It ostracizes people. It oppresses people. And it encourages them to destroy the environment so that they can make a lot of money. And none of that is particularly beneficial to the species or to the planet. And so I don't have a lot of use for a lot of the rules that are set forth by those religions.
Yeah. They may maintain some social order there, but is that social order helpful to the environment, helpful to the individuals in the system?
Yes.
It's a totally different question. Yeah, which just sounds like what you were speaking to.
Yes. I mean, what I see in those populations are not people who are happy. I see people who are scared. Mm-hmm. And they're scared to stick out. They're scared to be different. They're scared to get sideways of the opinions of the rest of their cohort. And it's really, it's not a very pretty thing. They don't feel they can be themselves. And I think that's really a tragedy. Mm-hmm. But that's not what we're here to talk about. We're here to talk about what we're doing and about paganism generally, because it's a growing movement, especially in the United States and Europe. And having moral and ethical underpinnings to it is a really important piece of the puzzle.
Yeah. So for me, when I start thinking about concepts, one of the things that helps me is trying to define terms. And we often use the terms morals, ethics, values, those all get bantered around in conversation, sometimes used interchangeably, but having subtle differences. So do you want to speak for a moment to how you would distinguish between those concepts?
Sure. I consider values fundamentally to come down to what a religion considers to be sacred. So, for example, in authoritarian religions, obedience is considered to be sacred. You are acting in accordance with the will of divinity when you are being obedient. In my estimation, the sacred is an opinion. It's not inherently sewn into anything. There are no sacredness bosons that apply sacredness to things out there in the cosmos, the way the Higgs boson applies mass.
That would shake up the standard model.
It certainly would. Yeah. It would, by very much so. But sacredness is an opinion that each of us can ascribe on our own to what we consider to be truly sacred. And within the framework of atheopaganism, the particular non-theist pagan flavor that I practice, there are four things that are considered sacred. And they are truth, beauty, love, and the world. The world meaning the cosmos generally, but more specifically the biosphere, mm-hmm. The ecological interpenetration of systems and creatures that makes up the fabric of life on Earth. And so those are the values. Those are the good things, right, that we want to orient our behavior around supporting. And so, you know, truth is important, not operating according to lies and not being deluded is a really important thing in order to navigate the world in a successful way. It's mm-hmm. one thing to tell yourself that gay people are sinful, but empirically, you make a lot of people miserable by doing that. You can drive people into suicide by doing that. So is it really a good thing to think that gay people are sinful? I would argue it is not. Mm-hmm. That's not the truth. The truth is that gay people are people like everybody else, and they have a right to be here, and that right should be supported. So that's truth. Beauty is something that tends to be ignored by our Western culture a lot because it's dismissed as simply aesthetics. Mm-hmm. An example that I used recently was a pristine stretch of desert, which is beautiful to an observer, but it also has an oil field underneath it. And in our culture, more often than not, the value of the oil field underneath it will be used as the rationalization for sacrificing the beauty of the pristine desert. I believe that aesthetic beauty itself inspires us to be happy, and it inspires us to be filled with love for the fact of being alive and for being connected with the world and the cosmos of which we are an extension. And so I believe that beauty isn't in and of itself sacred. It's enough to say this is beautiful and therefore it shouldn't be destroyed.
So it inspires that wonder or that awe.
Yes.
That we named this whole podcast after. Right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Because at root, that's where my paganism comes from.
Mm-hmm.
My paganism fundamentally comes from that wow experience of the magnificence of the universe, and particularly of this amazing planet.
Mm-hmm.
So that's beauty. Love, I think, is kind of self-explanatory. Love is that circumstance between people, or sometimes people and other creatures, that is healing and mutually supportive and kind and generous, and which can heal wounds. It can help people to recover from damage. It is that thing which, more than anything else, gives us a sense of meaning and of joy in living.
Mm-hmm.
And as social creatures, I believe love is just fundamental in a sacred manner.
Yeah.
And then finally, there is the world or the biosphere. And I think that one is also kind of self-evident. We wouldn't be here. We wouldn't be breathing. We wouldn't be eating. We wouldn't be not frozen if it weren't for the functioning of this remarkable, extraordinary, infinitely, or nearly infinitely, because I don't believe in infinities, complex planet.
Mm-hmm.
Of which we are extrusions, literally.
Yeah.
We literally arise from the body of this planet. And then when we no longer function, our component parts are taken apart and they go into something else.
Exactly, yeah.
So those are the four things that I hold as sacred. And I can talk in a minute about the principles that derive from that, which are the implementation of those values into a set of kind of rules for living.
Mm-hmm.
But I'd like to turn it over to you, Arwen, and talk about, you know, what's sacred to you?
Yeah. I pause because that is such a deep question to think about. And I have not...
I'm sorry, I put you on the spot.
Oh, no, that's okay. I haven't written a book about it yet, thinking about exactly what those things are. But I think much of what you just spoke to really resonates with me as well. I don't know if I would have used some of the same terms, but as you talked about the valuing of the biosphere, you know, that definitely made sense to me, going, okay, yes. And you were saying, without that, we would not have any of these other things, anything from simply being, from existing as material organism, to the things like poetry and music and all of the things that, when we talk about values, that we might mean, like saying, valuing privacy. You know, privacy wouldn't exist if we didn't exist, or families wouldn't exist if the biosphere. Those four things definitely resonated deeply with me. And I also share the appreciation and the value for truth. Truth in that there is an objective outside of us as well. Truth.
Yes.
And I know that that is one that is not necessarily shared between all people who call themselves pagan or all people within our culture, but it is something that, at least for me with my background in the sciences, was very much valued within that community and drilled into a point that sometimes it's hard to even see that these values are choices, because they're so present around us and we're influenced by everyone else as well, that it can be hard to step back and look at one's beliefs and separate ourselves out from our beliefs enough to be able to see them. So I am inspired now to have some period of reflection and really see if I can come up with a core set of things that I believe are sacred in the way that you came up with your four, and to define those.
Well, that's great. It's always exciting when I talk with somebody and they go, oh, that's really interesting. I want to think about that one.
Yeah. Yeah. So I would definitely love to invite the listeners to, you know, do that as well, if that's something that speaks to you.
Absolutely.
But I did mention, it seemed to me like you went straight to the core of it all with your four, but we also have values which are a little, I suppose, more surface values, like what I talked about, you know, valuing privacy or valuing, you know, you hear family values bantered around, whatever that means, valuing kindness. Those are things that I think are also important to discuss and talk about as well.
I agree. I think when I was kind of going through the process of distilling all this stuff and thinking about, you know, what is it that strikes me as really just core and non-negotiable. Mm-hmm. Those four things were the things that really were non-negotiable to me. There are societies, for example, that don't really have much in the way of privacy.
Yeah.
Whatever privacy they have is inside their own heads, but it's not really external to them the way, particularly the English-speaking world, mm-hmm. really focuses on personal space and privacy.
Yeah.
You know, I see those as being more subjective and cultural rather than being kind of universal.
Sure.
And I should say, when I say universal, I don't mean everybody subscribes to them, because there are people that don't think that the biosphere matters at all.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean that it doesn't. It just means that they don't think so.
Mm-hmm.
As I said at the beginning, the sacred is an opinion. The example that I often use, and I use in my book, is that if I have 2 4-by-4 pieces of lumber and I attach them to one another at right angles, suddenly I have a sacred object to Christians.
Mm-hmm.
But to me, it's just lumber.
Sure.
So there's an opinion making, a leap of decision that is invested in deciding what is sacred. And so these things, to me, are sacred because they're so integral to a life that is grounded in reality and happy and balanced and joyful. And so those are kind of the criteria that I used for making that decision.
Mm-hmm.
But there are a lot of other things out there, like privacy, for example, that we can decide are important. I am not one of those people that doesn't want any privacy. I do. and I think that when I get to talking about the Atheopagan principles, you'll see that there are attributes of respect for others sewn into that, which I think naturally derive principles like privacy.
Mm-hmm.
If you respect someone, then you respect what their needs are and you work to accommodate them.
Yeah.
So those are my thinking about that kind of thing. But as I say, they don't quite rise to the level of being sort of sacred, non-negotiable mm-hmm. things in my world. But once again, it's an opinion, right?
Yep. Okay. Well, do you want to dive into those principles?
Sure. I can do that.
Yeah.
I think most of the people that are listening, or at least some of the people who are listening, know that I wrote a book, Atheopaganism, An Earth-Honoring Path Rooted in Science. Which you can get from Barnes & Noble or Amazon, but please don't. It's best to order it from your independent bookstore.
Or the materials available on your blog as well. Yes, if they don't want to spend money.
That's right. If you don't want to spend money, the vast majority of the material in the book is available on atheopaganism.org. And you'll find all the stuff we're talking about there. So as sort of an implementation of those four sacred things, I devised 13 sacred principles, and I was kind of happy with the number because it's the number of moon cycles in the year. Mm-hmm. Pagans tend to be real fond of the number 13, some of which I think is just contrarian.
Yeah.
But it is the number of moon cycles in a year, so that is something sacred about it. So these are the 13 Atheopagan principles. The first is skepticism and critical thinking. So application of a thoughtful, logical, analytical process to determining what you believe and understanding that the metaphorical is not the literal. And this is important to get at that first sacred piece of truth, because it's very easy for our brains to create experiences that will confuse us.
Mm-hmm.
The brain is filtering a tremendous amount of information, and it's cherry picking what it wants to see. And often it's cobbling that together into something that didn't really happen outside our skin.
Mm-hmm.
We have experiences all the time that are not exactly what actually happened in physical reality. And this is an important thing to be aware of.
And we modify that over time too. That
yes,
memory
we do.
Of that experience.
Yes, yeah. Memory is constantly under re-editing. Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
This is something I write about quite a bit in the book. The second principle is reverence. I honor the earth which produced and sustains humanity. And so that's the implementation of the sacredness of the biosphere. The third is gratitude. I am grateful. And that goes to both beauty and the biosphere, because it's great to be here. And none of us was owed this. We're here through the longest possible series of happy accidents that led to each one of us as individuals being here on earth. And so having a practice that acknowledges our gratitude for that is an important piece towards having a happy and fulfilled life. The fourth is humility. I'm humble because none of us is any better than anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really important to get that at a very visceral level. Whatever your accomplishments, whatever your expertise, you're still just another ape critter on planet Earth wandering around, and it's really important to keep that in mind. Sort of associated with that is perspective. I laugh a lot, including at myself.
Yeah.
Laughter is an important part of human experience, and one of the things that I find most off-putting about many religious paths is that they take themselves so damn seriously. We're funny creatures, we humans, and it's a funny life. And if we can't laugh at it, if we can't find humor in our own foibles and in those of our society and in those of the world at large, then we're really kind of missing out on something, and we're losing track of a valuable perspective about the fundamental absurdity of everything, as well as the fundamental seriousness and gravity of everything.
Yeah. And that laughter brings us, that equalizes it, brings us together.
Indeed, it does. The sixth principle is praxis. I enact regular ritual in observance of my religion. And this is an important piece because it's the place where atheopaganism firmly becomes not a philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
Philosophies contain cosmologies and value sets, but they generally do not contain practices. You don't hear about, you know, the holiday calendar of the Stoics, or the Pythagorean weekly sacrifice. They just, those things don't happen. The seventh principle is inclusiveness. I celebrate diversity and am respectful of difference.
Mm-hmm.
And that once again is a special case of humility. We're all equal. We're all in this together. and it doesn't matter what color you are, and it doesn't matter what gender you are, and it doesn't matter what who you love. All of us are fundamentally equal in our value here on Earth. Mm-hmm. And when I say it doesn't matter, I don't mean I don't care. What I mean is, when it comes to valuation of a person, we're all on the same playing field here.
Yeah.
The eighth principle is legacy. I recognize and embrace my responsibility to the young and future generations. And this is very important. This is a very common principle in many indigenous cultures, where decisions get made with a mind to what's going to happen to generations going forward. Mm-hmm. Our society, which is built more on the quarterly returns of corporate profit, doesn't think of that at all. And it's mm-hmm. devastating. It's destroying us. And we really need to start getting our minds around the idea that the implications of our actions for those that come after us need to be central in our thinking.
Yes, yeah.
The ninth principle is responsibility, and specifically about the relationship between freedom and responsibility. And this is something that the pagan community writ large doesn't do a very good job with. You see a lot of very, very libertarian folks out there. I want to be able to do whatever I want to do. And so they do. But when we acknowledge that freedom is tempered by responsibility, and that we have responsibility to those around us and to the world itself, mm-hmm. that draws a line around what our freedoms can be. It's not okay just to do some really lucrative, really polluting activity and dump all your pollution into a passing stream so that it goes into somebody else's water supply. That's not okay.
Yeah.
Our freedom must be tempered by our sense of responsibility to others. Mm. The 10th is pleasure positive. I celebrate pleasure as inherently good as long as others are not harmed in its pursuit and the four pillars of life, love, beauty, and truth are respected. And this is probably where the Ethiopagan principles diverge most completely from sort of Western civilization values, mm-hmm. particularly since the rise of Christianity, but particularly since Calvin and Luther. The idea that things that feel good are just good really went out the window. The association of pleasure with sin and guilt is deeply sewn into our society. And, you know, those of us who are raised just even in secular society here, we learn a lot of this because we're steeping in it like tea. It's something that soaks into us whether we wish we did or not.
Yeah, I can definitely, even as someone who wasn't raised Christian, someone who's raised pagan, I have found myself dealing with that belief from society and trying to separate myself from it. But it's powerful. It's there.
Very much so.
Yeah.
And particularly around sexuality, which of course freaks people out so much. Mm-hmm. The most interesting statistic that I've ever seen about sexuality is that something like 85% of people have what are called paraphilias, which are things they like in sex. And those can be very unusual, like shoe fetish, mm-hmm. or they can just be, I like to be touched this particular way, you know, these particular nerve endings really get me off, that kind of thing.
Only 85?
Yeah, well, that's the number that I've read is 85. Meaning that our idea of normal, our idea about normal sex, mm-hmm. it doesn't exist. It doesn't exist at all. Everybody out there has stuff that is kind of specialized that works for them. Mm-hmm. And they're all feeling guilty about it because they think it's weird or shameful or
The big W word, wrong.
Wrong or abnormal.
Yeah.
And it's just, there's just such, there's no need for this at all. There's, it benefits no one. It does no good for the world. Hmm. And I know that that there are Abrahamic religions which have all of these rules about stuff you can do and stuff you can't do. But honestly, I think that's a lot of hooey. I just don't buy it. Mm-hmm. I think people should do what feels good to them unless they're hurting somebody else or the planet itself.
Yeah.
So long story short, pleasure positive is number 10. Number 11 is curiosity. I understand that knowledge is never complete. There's mm-hmm. always more to be learned. Mm-hmm. And this is really important in order to have a truly scientific mindset, because I call myself an atheist, but what I mean by that is that I am 99.9% sure that there are no independent, invisible beings out there that are gods. But I have to leave that extra 0.1% because new data may come along tomorrow. And if it does, I have to be open to it and willing to consider it.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the scientific mindset. The scientific mindset is not about knowing. It's about knowing with high probability.
Mm-hmm.
And so curiosity becomes a necessary piece in order to keep yourself from becoming an ideologue. The 12th is integrity. I conduct myself with integrity in word and deed. And that's just, that's that basic social contract thing. We were talking about game theory earlier. And if you're an untrustworthy person, people will not collaborate with you because they won't believe that you're going to do what's in their best interests. Mm-hmm. So it's entirely beneficial to everyone concerned that you be true to your word and do what you say you're going to do, and not be duplicitous in your dealings with other people. And that's what this plank is about. And then the last is kindness and compassion. Hmm. I practice kindness and compassion with others and myself, recognizing that they and I will not always meet the standards set by these principles. So it's important to be kind. It's important to be compassionate. And it's also important to be kind and compassionate with yourself, because even if you live according to a set of principles, as I do, you're going to fall off the wagon. You're going to get mad and you're going to say something mean to people. It's inevitable.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to be compassionate with yourself around that. Do what you can to make it right or not to do it the next time. But you have to be able to avoid the most useless emotion in human experience, which is guilt, which does no good for anyone. It just doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
So those are the 13 Atheopagan principles. And that's the framework, the behavioral framework within which I seek to live my life.
Wonderful. So as you were describing them, the question for me came up, would you distinguish those from ethics? What is that difference between principles and ethics?
No, I think they're ethical principles. I would say those are my ethics.
Okay. Yeah. Because, ethics, at least my understanding would be the code that we, by which we behave, and that often is associated with a group as well. Right. That's the ethics of Atheopaganism, or to be a little bit more mundane, the medical profession has certain ethics. It's the way that we conduct ourselves, the things that we believe are okay or not okay to do.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes,
exactly. So the Atheopagan group on Facebook, for example, is, to the best we're able, we operate and moderate that group according to the Atheopagan principles. That's mm-hmm. that the idea is we're going to try to conduct ourselves according to these ideas.
Yeah. And actually, I'm going to tie this back to what we were talking about in the beginning about how there isn't a, you know, big bearded authority figure telling you to do these things. But a lot of them seem like they just make good sense.
Yes. If you want to get along with other people and you want to live a life that's happy, this stuff really isn't rocket science. I mean, one of the, or it isn't rocket surgery, as my friend says to me, one of my favorite sayings. One of the pieces of feedback that I've had on my book, which I consider kind of the highest praise that I've received, is that so much of what's in there just seems very natural and common sense. It just seems like, well, yeah, that's true. And well, yeah, that's true too.
Yeah, that makes sense. Okay, yeah.
Yeah, this makes sense. There's, and I don't claim to be breaking new ground with most of it. I mean, the sort of implementation pieces around how to structure rituals and stuff like that, sure, I had a creative part in that. But an awful lot of it was just thinking about life and thinking about the experience of being human and then trying to just be very matter of fact and sensible about it rather than ideological about it. Mm-hmm. And that's where those principles come from. So we were going to talk also about ethics in the pagan community. So why don't we do a little bit of that?
Yeah, so speaking a little bit to the ethics that it seems like the whole community shares, and then where each of us differ somewhat from that, and recognizing that the pagan community is a huge community, even though we often talk about it as, you know, this monolith, the pagan community, there are so many different people who identify under that umbrella. That sometimes, to me, it seems like the only thing that we have in common is that we call ourselves pagans.
I literally believe that that's the case. The diversity under the umbrella of paganism is so vast that I can't think of any other characteristic that is universal to all of its participants other than just being human. I think that self-identifying as a pagan is what makes you one.
Yeah.
And there are those, of course, who will adamantly argue that that's not the case. But they tend to be the kinds of folks that want to gatekeep the community and say, okay, these people don't belong, those people don't belong.
But I belong.
Well, of course.
Yeah.
I mean, I had an online conversation a couple of weeks ago with somebody who argued that Wicca was an edge case. Maybe Wicca is pagan. Maybe it's not. And okay. Consider, I mean, and of course, you know, this person was a historical reconstructionist and felt like, well, no, you know, if you're not following old gods from 1,000, 2,000, 3,000 years ago, then you're not really a pagan. And that's just not the case. I mean, from the beginning of the pagan resurgence in the late 60s into the 1970s, there have been people who thought of gods as metaphors. There have been people who believed in a god and a goddess, which was an entirely modern creation, rolling up all of those different historical belief patterns into a single figure. There have been those who believed in literal gods. There have been those who believed in archetypal gods. There have been those who believed in only particular historical gods and not others. So really all we can say about this community in terms of its commonality is that it's who shows up. Mm-hmm. It's who self-identifies and shows up. And then also that it is a broad category of alternative non-Abrahamic religions that are on the rise in the English-speaking world at this time.
Yeah. Mostly, though, because there are the, like, Christo-Wiccans and Christo-Pagans who yes. bring in some of that element as well.
That's very true. That's so, very true. And I hadn't thought of that. Yes. And of course, they're at the top of the list for those that
that get picked on.
Are gatekeeping, you know, really want to throw out of the community. My feeling is that when you're an extreme religious minority, even though we've grown tremendously in the last 30 years, just tremendously. And I mean, I've been around to see that. You grew up in it, but I've been around to see the difference in sheer population of pagans from the mid-70s when I first, I'm sorry, mid-80s when I first got started to today.
Yeah, it's not just a bad word anymore. It is in some parts of the country, but people even know that it's a religion now.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And particularly they know that Wicca is a religion because it's been recognized, you know, by the US military and so forth and so on. But we're still this tiny religious minority. And when you're that small of a religious minority, it makes a whole lot more sense to make common cause with one another and stick together than it does to start forming circular firing squads and figuring out who gets thrown out of the tent.
Yeah, because then before you know it, there's only 12 people in your religion.
Yeah, but boy, are they pure.
Yes.
They're incredibly pure.
Yes, pure and high.
Yes.
Yeah.
So we were going to talk about ethics in the pagan community, and a lot has actually been written about this in recent years. It's been brought to my attention that there's been quite a bit of writing on pagan ethics in publications like The Pomegranate. And I'm glad to see that that's the case. But what I see happening out there in the community writ large is still what I consider to be very inadequate. And it boils down to two Wiccan ideas, which not everybody subscribes to, which are the Wiccan read, which is if it doesn't harm anybody, do what you will.
Yeah.
Which is simply inadequate, in my opinion, because defining harm is very, very difficult.
And anyone.
Anyone. Right. I mean, you know, as we speak, I'm killing bacteria left and right just by the course of the operation of my body. And what am I supposed to do about that?
Yeah.
You know, stop operating my body?
Yeah, well, that doesn't work that way. And then you would be, you'd be killing all of the microbes that depend upon you for survival if you died.
That's right.
Right? So
that's right.
That's, this is nature, you know?
Ethical questions rarely have one size fits all broad brush answers. And that's why there are 13 Ethiopagan principles instead of two.
Now you said the read, and what was the other one?
The other is the so-called threefold law, which is the idea that whatever you do will rebound to you three times, which first of all is magical thinking. I don't believe that the universe has some sort of tallying system that's able to assess what's good and what's bad and then sends responses to people based on what their accounts look like. That doesn't make any sense to me at all. And I know that a great number of pagans don't believe it either, but it's the only stricture in many pagan circles against just being a complete creep.
Yeah.
The idea that you're going to be punished for it. And the whole idea of cosmic punishment really smacks of Abrahamic deific punishment to me. You know, it turns deific authoritarianism into universal authoritarianism. It makes it into this sort of dispassionate mechanism instead of the will of Yahweh smacking you down because you did something bad. But really, in many pagan circles, those are the only ethical principles. And I just think that they're totally inadequate. I think a much more nuanced articulation of what is valuable and of how we should live and how we should be with one another is really necessary. And I don't see much indication, given the strongly libertarian bent of many in that community, I don't see much sign that they're moving in that direction.
What you described in terms of those two things really being the only kind of common ethics, it definitely reflects much of my experience as well. And then some groups borrow more heavily from other religions, whether it's accurate the way they're describing it, but bringing the idea of karma as a continuation of that threefold law.
Yes.
Now, I think there's some elements of truth in that how you behave there's going to be natural consequences.
Yes.
Right. Oh. You know, if I'm a jerk to you, you're going to go, I'm not going to do this podcast with you anymore. Right. So,
right.
But that doesn't mean, at least I don't think that means that it's going to be exactly three times. I don't see how the math would work out on that anyways.
Yeah. How exactly do you measure that? If I'm rude to you, then what? Three people are rude to me, or one person is three times as rude to me, or.
But then if they're rude to me, won't they have three people be rude to them?
Or someone be three times as rude, which is kind of hard to figure out exactly how you calculate that.
But then we're getting into nine times as rude from someone, you know.
Exactly. And that's unfair. So then it's my turn to be more rude. Yeah. Whoever came up with this didn't think it out very much.
Yeah. I mean, I appreciate the goal, though, of expressing a way of trying to express that, you know, we should be decent to each other. You know, watch that. Like, don't spend your time being nasty and angry. That's not going to help you in the long run. I appreciate that.
Right. And the idea is that, I mean, there's the principle of personal responsibility sewn into that. And the idea that, but there's also this very pernicious idea, I think, which is the idea of creating your own reality, which is a very blame the victim kind of thing. And I've seen pagans who go there. You know, all these terrible things have happened to me. What must I have done?
Yeah.
Either now or in a past life, which is always sort of the safety valve explanation for anything that doesn't make any sense.
Yeah. Especially to explain why terrible things happen to children.
Yes.
Right. Well, they must have done something when they weren't a child at some point.
Yeah. Infants with brain cancer. It's kind of hard to explain how they could have done something. You know, so awful in the 3 months of life that they, you know, deserve this horrible fate. So I just think that there hasn't been a lot of thinking around some of that stuff, but there's also been a general shying away from discussion or contemplation of ethics within much of the broader pagan community. And this is not true of all pagan communities, for example. I mean, I know that Greek Reconstructionists, they have volumes and volumes and volumes of ethical thought by all these various philosophers, some of whom were atheists, but let's not talk about that. And, you know, they're, in many cases, they're subscribing to a particular school of thought and trying to live according to those rules. Mm-hmm. But in the general community, I just haven't seen that much of an adherence to a standard. And part of what that's enabled people to do, particularly sort of charismatic leaders, is to be abusive, to be exploitative, and to take advantage of people in the name of giving them magical training or teaching them ancient secrets, or simply giving them more power within whatever little community they happen to be in. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we've seen our share of sexually abusive pagan leaders, just as other religious communities have.
Yeah.
And it doesn't help that there is this ethic of being pleasure positive in the pagan community, which is a good thing, but there's a difference between being sex positive and saying that all things that are sexual are good.
Yeah.
And a lot of people lose that distinction.
Especially when we're still coming out of the culture that we are, still healing from a lot of that inherited trauma around sex.
Indeed. Yeah. Indeed. Because one of the things that happens with victims is they're ashamed.
Yeah.
And so they're not willing to, in many cases, they're not willing to go public because they're ashamed about what they did. Mm-hmm. And that derives from that fundamental, you know, guilt, shame complex that we have around sexuality. So not to belabor this too much, but I do feel that there is a real place for development of moral and ethical thinking in the pagan community, and that as we grow and expand, this is kind of an Achilles heel right now, and it's a place where we really need to grow.
Yeah. And, you know, I suspect that you observed that there isn't a lot of conversation in most of the community around this. And one of the reasons I suspect might be because many people are coming out of other religions in which they were told, this is what you have to be, this is how you have to behave. And paganism can be a real breath of fresh air. It's
yes.
Paganism can often allow people to express themselves and to feel more free. But on the same side, people are very cautious about trying to restrict any of that.
Yes.
So if you have that conversation of, well, do we want to believe this? Do we believe this is right? I don't believe this is right, wrong. You can get people very quickly becoming quite defensive because of those old wounds that they're dealing with.
Yes, very much so. There was, I don't even remember where it was. There was an online conversation, I think in a Facebook group. And what it was about was people wearing or carrying BDSM gear at a pagan pride event. And it was very complicated because you've got all these folks that are into BDSM and they're like, no, this is me, I'm proud.
Uh-huh.
And then you've got these other people who are saying, but a pride event is supposed to be us engaging the broader community. And to some degree, in a way that feels like it's safe for the broader community. And it's not really our fault that those people are repressed in this way and think that BDSM is bad. But wouldn't it be better if we just left that stuff at home for this particular event?
Yeah.
And people were outraged. And I don't think there is a good answer. I mean, when you're talking about a pride event, you're also talking about being out as who you are, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it was a very interesting conversation, and of course it all went to hell. It didn't lead to any kind of, you know, resolution or agreeing to disagree or any of that kind of thing. But it was an interesting talk.
Yeah. Well, I definitely think this is a conversation that we should return to, not just you and I, but the broad pagan community and our slightly smaller, you know, non-theist pagan community, you know, time and time again.
I think so too, because it goes to the question of who do we really want to be?
Mm-hmm.
You know, who do we want to be and what do we want to be exponents of in the world? And those are always important conversations to have. I think one of the ways that the established religions have gotten really hidebound and stuck is because they've stopped having those conversations, thinking that it's all worked out in their holy book.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not a living tradition. Even if you keep reading the book, it's not alive.
Yeah.
It's just looking at the pattern of dead bacteria in the petri dish. So one of the advantages that we have, I think, being a, to some degree, make it yourself kind of religious family, is that we have an opportunity to have those conversations and kind of refresh them for ourselves. And things will change, you know, new stuff will come along. Things are changing in the realm of gender so fast that yeah. it's likely that we're going to need to have whole new conversations around that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's good. That's yeah. good. You know, we need to be able to keep up with how culture is evolving. Right. So do we have other questions for today, or is...
I think for today, I think this probably, we actually went a little bit longer than we normally do. No surprise, there's a lot in here. But I think this is probably a great place to go ahead and wrap it up.
All right, let's do that then. Thank you so much, everyone, for listening to The Wonder. We're really delighted to have you along on this journey with us. And I'm Mark Green.
And thank you, everyone. I'm Yekka, and we will see you next week.